Hello, this is your Polycast for Thursday, August 25th, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom. On today's edition, Governor Dayton looks for ways to save the Southwest Light Rail Transit Project and a chat with the Republican running for Congress in the 7th District. A proposed minimum wage ballot issue in Minneapolis is going to the state Supreme Court, Matt Sepik reports.
Over the objections of the city council, a Hennepin County judge ruled Monday that a ballot question that would ask voters to raise the city's minimum wage to $15 an hour must go on the November ballot. The city appealed and requested accelerated review. The state's high court set oral arguments for August 30th. Mayor Betsy Hodges supports a higher minimum wage, but says the city charter does not allow for putting the issue to voters.
I believe that it should be higher. I've been clear about that the whole time. The strategy to get there in Minneapolis, region-wide, statewide, and nationally is what the question is.
Backers of the charter amendment say a higher minimum wage would reduce poverty and racial income disparities. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
St. Paul Mayor Chris Coleman says he's asking the city council to up its proposed property tax levy increase in 2017 to 7%. Tim Nelson has more.
A letter from the mayor to the city council says the breakdown of talks over a potential special legislative session means the city isn't going to get an expected $3 million boost in state aid. Finance officials say simply cutting the money could cost the city up to 9 police officers, shutter one of the city's recreation centers, and trim Coleman's racial equity initiatives. Coleman proposed a 4% tax increase earlier this month and hoped lawmakers would pass a new tax bill. The city's finance director says the 7% increase is a worst-case scenario at this point, but the potential increase would push St. Paul's tax hike past the 5.5% proposed by Minneapolis Mayor Betsy Hodges earlier this month, although her budget already assumed a loss in state aid. Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Governor Mark Dayton is looking for fresh options to get the Southwest Light Rail Transit Line built. The final piece of funding for the $1.8 billion project is up in the air after special session talks broke down last week. The governor has invited legislators, local government officials, and business leaders to a public meeting today to discuss what's next for the proposed line between Minneapolis and Eden Prairie. Tim Pugmire has the story.
Southwest Light Rail still needs $135 million in local money in order to leverage $895 million in federal funds. But lawmakers failed to provide the state share during the 2016 session, and a last-ditch plan to allow Hennepin County to cover the remaining cost crashed on the final night. They also failed to reach a deal for a summer special session to address the transit issue and other unresolved matters. DFL Senator Scott Dibble of Minneapolis says he thinks the entire project is now in jeopardy.
This isn't good. This is not a good development for Southwest Light Rail Transit, and by extension, it's not a good development for building out a robust transit system in the metropolitan area that puts us on the same footing with other metropolitan areas. So we're in pretty bad shape.
Dibble, the chair of the Senate Transportation Committee, said he plans to attend the governor's meeting, but he said he's not sure there are any viable funding options to consider. He thinks the impasse can only be resolved in November with the election of more transit-friendly legislators. Other Southwest supporters believe there are still options. Pat Mulqueeney, president of the Eden Prairie Chamber of Commerce, said one potential funding source is the state's Fiscal Disparities Program. It was created 45 years ago to even out the property tax burden in the metro area. Mulqueeney said Eden Prairie is a net loser under the program.
Times have changed since 1972, let's put it that way, and metro transportation is a much stronger need for the region, and that fiscal disparities dollars could be utilized metro-wide on transportation projects, and in this case, dollars could be put towards Southwest LRT.
House Republicans firmly oppose the light rail funding. They also recently began arguing that there's no urgency to take action. As evidence, GOP House Speaker Kurt Dowd points to an email that the Metropolitan Council Chair Adam Dunick sent Governor Dayton in January, in which he said federal officials were holding off on a funding agreement until 2017 due to pending legal challenges.
He's hid that from the public and from the legislature and from the press since January of this year. We know that he's known about it for at least that long. And how he expects the state to fund it prior to the lawsuits being resolved, or, you know, why he thinks that it's timely. If we know the federal government's not going to fund it for a year and a half, there is no deadline. There is no reason that we have to take action now on Southwest Light Rail.
Despite that email, a Met Council spokeswoman insisted that the federal money is not being held up by the pending litigation. Dunnick issued a statement this week countering Doubt's no deadline claim. Dunnick said a decision is needed as a practical matter by August 31st. Without local funding commitments by then, we will be forced to begin shutting down the office and project permanently, he wrote. Dunnick also noted that a major engineering contractor has already moved some staff off the project until the funding issue is resolved. He said the delay is adding an estimated $1 million each week to the project cost. Covering politics, I'm Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Every seat in Congress is on the ballot in November, and in western Minnesota, Republican Dave Hughes of Karlstad is trying to knock off longtime DFL Congressman Colin Peterson. Hughes is a 47-year-old former Air Force pilot. I asked him why he decided to run.
I decided to run because I think our nation has been on the wrong course for a long, long time, decades now, perhaps as far back as FDR. And so I've been watching and observing for the last 25 years, developing my political philosophy and cementing my political positions and stances, and wish to turn this ship around and head us in a much different, much freer, and more prosperous direction. That's why I'm running.
Since FDR, what's the problem? What's the biggest problem you see that you think needs addressing?
Well, there's a number of things that are my priorities, but if you had to sum it up in a single statement or a single issue, it's the Leviathan, the huge and ever-increasing size and scope of the federal government, both in terms of its intrusion into our lives as well as spending. You know, we see now $19-plus trillion national debt with anywhere from $100 to $200 trillion in unfunded liabilities out there in the near-term horizon. And nobody in Congress on either side of the aisle is addressing it, nor has seriously in the last several years.
And most of that spending goes for defense and what are called entitlement programs. So what would you cut?
Well, as you know, the defense budget is only about 16% of the total national budget. So in a $4 trillion a year annual budget, a $620 billion defense budget is only about 16%.
Okay, so what are you going to cut?
Well, I propose to eliminate quickly 5 of the 15 U.S. departments. But certainly, as you might be thinking, and as because you talked about entitlements, entitlement reform has to be front and center. Otherwise, we'll never solve this problem of, you know, $400, $500, $600 billion a year deficits and the growing debt. So we have to shrink the government in terms of total size, but we also have to address those entitlement programs.
So what does that mean? Do you make the retirement age later? Do you put a means test so if people who have a certain income can't get Social Security? Do you cut Medicare? What do you look at there?
Sure. I would imagine some or all of those things. Certainly, when Social Security was first created, the eligibility age was past the average lifespan of the adult American male. So he was expected to be dead before he was ever eligible. Certainly now, life expectancy is into the late 70s, early 80s, and so the eligibility age is still way down there, and that's part of the demographic problem. So I would be open to that, as well as perhaps means testing. But then there's other things like, looking at what some of the counties in the U.S. have done in terms of privatization or partial privatization.
Isn't the reason that so much money is spent in these areas and it's so hard to do the kind of things you're talking about is because people like their benefits? I mean, it's very popular spending. So how do you get that done? And how do you convince the voters that they should elect you to do it?
Well, you're absolutely right. People are pleased with the programs, particularly, say, Medicare and Medicaid. But we have to come together as politicians and leaders and produce the big picture and the complete picture for the American people. I mean, for instance, Medicare, probably one of the very popular programs, Politicians on both sides of the aisle, nobody disagrees with this. There is anywhere from $75 to $100 billion a year in fraud in just one program called Medicare. And if nobody talks about it, nobody trumpets it, nobody makes a big deal of it, but if members of Congress in both houses and in both parties made a big deal of it all the time, eventually perhaps the American populace would wake up to that and say, yeah, we should probably start reforming that.
But, and no one is denying fraud is a problem, but you have all these baby boomers now hitting retirement age, and that's going to continue for another 20 years. I mean, that's the real problem, isn't it? That you just have an aging population that wants these services and that they can fairly say they paid into the system all those years and they want to get something out of it.
Oh, yeah. And I'm not talking about cutting anybody off who is a current recipient or even near that. If you were going to do reform, you would do it in a way where, you know, you would eventually have like three different groups. You'd have current recipients, near-term recipients who are about to go on, and then those below a certain age at which they would, you know, their eligibility for that sort of thing in the future would be different based on how we reformed the programs.
What's your specific problem with Colin Peterson? He's been reelected for a long time in the district. What's he not doing right?
Well, he spends all of his time and attention on agriculture. I have complaints everywhere I go, 38 counties in Minnesota District 7, and it's a unanimous opinion everywhere I go that all he ever talks about is agriculture. Now, certainly that is the number one economic sector in our district, but there's a whole host of things that are critical at the national level that he seems to be neglecting and certainly is not exerting any leadership in. We come to national security and the issue of what to do with Guantanamo Bay and the detainees down there. He has voted several times to shut down that camp and move the detainees to American soil. That's not a positive thing and not something that the American people support, nor those of District 7. The other thing is, and I talked about it a minute ago, when Colin Peterson came into office in January 1991, the national debt was at about $3.5 trillion. It's now at $19-plus trillion. He never talks about the national debt. He never talks about the deficits. All he ever talks about is increasing spending and farm programs and so forth. And so he has not exerted leadership in that area as well. And so those are a couple of the problems that I have with Colin Peterson.
What do you think about Donald Trump?
Well, Donald Trump is our candidate, of course. And I like some of what he's been saying this week and last week. He stayed on message and seems to be doing well. I have some concerns about his public statements about trade. But I have to evaluate those further before I come to a final decision about the trade issue. In terms of his stance on protecting our borders and strengthening our immigration process, I think he's right on. Our borders are porous. Our interior enforcement is terrible. And our visa overstay process is badly in need of reform. So those three things definitely have to be done. Before we talk about legalization of the Dreamers.
Do you support building a wall along the entire Mexican border, and do you think Mexico would pay for that?
I do support building the wall. I don't particularly care much about the whole Mexican paying for it thing. Jeb Bush grossly overestimated the cost of building the border. I think he said something like $400 billion. More credible estimates based on the experience in Israel when Israel built their partition with the Palestinians, a more credible estimate is anywhere from $6 to $10 billion, and certainly we could do that.
You mentioned trade with Trump. He has said that NAFTA, he called it the worst trade deal in history. He says TPP not going to happen. Haven't those trade deals benefited Americans in many ways?
And, yes, absolutely.
And why do you need more time to evaluate what he says about that?
Well, he has said some negative things, and the media has portrayed some of his comments about trade being negative, which caused me concern. But I don't know the crux or the details or the context of those comments. That's what I need to evaluate further.
But in general, it sounds like you are not anti-trade deal. You think that trade deals do some good.
Oh, absolutely. I think that the trade deals have to be, I think in a number of areas, including agriculture, We must in the future, and the new ag bill will be up. They're going to start working on it next January in early 2017 for passage in 2018. Definitely, we have to do better trade deals that are more beneficial to the U.S. and have stronger enforcement mechanisms at the WTO. One of the problems is that some of the member nations, they cheat on the agreements, and so we need to be able to enforce those better. So I agree with Trump that we need to have better deals, but I think NAFTA is a net plus for the U.S. I think TPP, from what I can tell, will be a net plus.
How do you think you're going to do this year? Do you feel like you're a big underdog running against an entrenched incumbent who's been there for so long, or do you think you have a chance to really knock him off if you can get your message out?
Well, both. I am definitely the underdog. Colin Peterson has been in there for 26 years and has portrayed himself, you know, either fully accurately or partially accurately as a conservative blue dog. And so he appeals to the conservative, the culturally conservative nature of Minnesota's 7th district. But in every way, I'm more conservative than him. And I even have a problem with the idea of, say, Republican voters who would normally vote, you know, straight down the ticket, but then vote for him because of, you know, they say, hey, he votes right on two issues. He does have a pretty stellar record on the abortion issue and on gun rights issues. But the problem, of course, that is not new. The media knows this, and the media has defended Colin, is that the problem is that he is of absolutely zero influence in the Democratic Party at the national level with the leadership on those two subjects.
Is there anywhere that you disagree with your party? Would you go to Washington and vote anywhere against the Republican Party line?
Well, as a matter of their platform, I don't know that there's anything I disagree with, but one thing I do disagree with is the tendency in recent years to overspend.
So if the Republican Majority Speaker Paul Ryan came up with a slate of budget bills and the budget didn't balance when they were passed, you would vote no on each of them?
I think so, yes. I am balancing the budget is one of my highest priorities, and so I would push back against that and am prepared to vote no on those things.
That's Dave Hughes, the Republican candidate for Congress in Minnesota's 7th District. And that's your Polycast for this Thursday, your daily check-in on Minnesota politics. I'm Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom.